Easy money has been made in every commodity. Easy money is when an industry is hated enough that the selling price of the product on a global basis is less than the global cost of production, including tax and the cost of capital. So, as an example, when uranium was $20 and it cost $40 a pound to make it, the industry was losing $20 a pound about 150 million times a year. It was pretty boring, you know? But the resolution of that was either that the uranium price would go up or the lights would go out. Those were your only two choices. And uranium was hated. The easy money has been made. The sure money is ahead of us.
Good day, everybody. It's me, Just Steve Yang here, Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I am joined by Rick Rule, natural resource investor and leading voice in the commodity space. Rick, thank you so much for being here. So many people have benefited from your Rule Symposium, your Rule Classroom, and just from the knowledge you shared over the years. And I personally want to thank you for benefiting me. But thank you for your time. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. The better for being back on with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Rick, you've said natural resource stocks have been underinvested for quite some time. And we have supply constraints now increasingly showing up in energy and metals. Are we still early in a cycle? And how should investors be positioned right now?
I guess I believe that we are in the fifth or sixth inning of a nine-inning game. I think the next 10 years will be pretty good. I believe that the bull market that we're in began earlier than many people believe. I guess I believe that we're two-thirds of the way through. For speculators, by the way, the last third is usually the best. The blow-off top. We're nowhere near a blow-off top yet, in my own opinion.
When do you think the first inning started? Because you've been on this for a while now.
I'm going to say 2000. I think what kicked off this current market was the beginnings of the debasement of the US dollar on the one hand, which I think really began in about 2000, and the urbanization of China. It's very difficult to understate the importance of the material advancement of humankind. And I think the front wave of the advancement of humankind was Deng Xiaoping saying to be rich is glorious and moving 600 million Chinese from rural penury to being lower middle class or at least less poor. That circumstance continues around the world. And those are both important themes: the debasement of the US dollar, the debasement of all foreign currencies, and the increase in material well-being of the poorest of the poor around the world are really primary themes in the resource market.
If you can expand just a little bit more on the advancement of China accelerating this, and then also what accelerates it moving forward?
Without being excessively political, I guess. China's history, let's just say it's been a fairly tough place to be a human being. From the warlord days through the catastrophe of Chairman Mao, the starvation of 20 million people through collectivism, the realization after the death of Mao by people, particularly Deng Xiaoping, where he said to be rich is glorious, where you maintained the strict control of the state, but where you gave the opportunity for individual initiative, really, truly changed China. From a company with, country, pardon me, with 700 million, what the Russians would call kulaks, servants of the state, existing in rural subsistence agriculture in total penury, to a country, with over a billion urban or suburban dwellers in 30 years is one of the great material accomplishments of humankind. Nothing like it. the ability of all of those people to generate
Yeah.
value, and as a consequence of their generating value, increasing their level of material well-being can't be overstated. Steve, when you and I get more money, more disposable income, the things that add to our sense of well-being might be a great dinner out with friends, or some little device from Apple that uses no material but costs, $1,000 or something, or maybe a service of some kind. But if Steve Yang wasn't the Western Steve Yang, but rather a rural peasant in Sichuan in 1995, as your level of economic well-being increased, the goods that meant a difference to you, that increased your living standards, were all material. It might be that you were able, as a consequence of having more money, to raise your family's calorie count from 1500 to 2200. I'm not arguing for obesity, by the way. You went from being barefoot to having tennis shoes, to being the first in your family to have a bicycle, to having a 50cc motorcycle, and now a Toyota Hilux. You went from having a thatch roof to having a steel roof. You went from having a mud hut to having cinder block walls. And most importantly, you got electricity. I'm personalizing this. I'm pointing out how the increase in living standards among the poorest of the poor in China transformed the world and transformed from their resource business. And I'm asking you to consider that the rest of the world becomes China now, Malawi, Myanmar, parts of Indonesia. There are 1 billion people on Earth, Steve, that still have no access to primary electricity. They want to live like you and I. And I believe over the next 20 years, we solve that problem. We've done a great job as humankind, led by China. Taking 2 billion people from abject poverty to being just plain poor, which is a hell of an accomplishment. And I believe over the next 10 years, or pardon me, over the next 20 years, we finish the job. But what's important to remember is that finishing the job increases the material intensity of those lifestyles, in particular, the energy density of those lifestyles. And I think that no investment portfolio in natural resources can be founded without the knowledge that the ascent of humankind, which has been impressive and will continue, means that more and more and more people will want to and increasingly be able to compete with you and I for material goods and energy. And this is a good thing, not necessarily good for you and I, because more competition means that we have to pay more for what we need. But good for humankind in a profound way.
So you talked about China, and as energy demands, all over the world rises, and the world electrifies, how do you see uranium and nuclear today, and which countries are best positioned? You said China being one of them.
I see it the way the Chinese see it right now. I'm not necessarily in favor of a totalitarian political system. The last time I was in Shanghai, an assistant to the mayor of Shanghai was talking about this major project. And I said, how long will it take you to get it approved? He said it was approved. He said it was proposed on Thursday, and it was approved the next Tuesday. That's pretty amazing. The Chinese, and I don't want to make the interview all about China, but we'll use that as the sort of standard. The Chinese right now per capita use about 20% as much electricity as the average American. They've accomplished all of the growth that they've caused to occur in China with energy consumption that's a fifth of the average American's energy consumption. If, as a consequence of increasing lifestyles, they can take that aggregate number to 30%, there almost isn't that much energy on the planet. raising them being the Chinese, from 5% of per capita consumption in the US to 20% of energy consumption in the US means that China consumes now about half the surplus energy in the world. So that gives you an idea of the order of magnitude challenge involved in increasing the material standards of living on a global basis. With specific regards to uranium, the Chinese have understood and admit, unlike the United States, that particulate pollution is a health challenge in China. The Chinese government says that a half a million people a year die as a consequence of cardiovascular challenges from particulate pollution, coal burning, oil and gas burning. And when the Chinese government prices things like wind and solar, which are uneconomic, they add in a very, very cold calculation of the cost of particulate pollution in human terms. Part of the equation that if we do it on a narrative basis. The Chinese would suggest, the Chinese government would suggest that mortality has a cost that the state must bear. It's a very, very different calculation and a shrewd one, I think. The Chinese government has recognized that they require a lot of electricity, that they require base load electricity. Yes, solar, because they need that too. Yes, wind, because they need that too. But base load power. And they get base load power either from burning coal, and by the way, they're building coal plants like mad, or particularly in urban areas where they can't afford that much particulate pollution, nuclear power. A second thing, since you asked me about uranium, I'm sorry for this long-winded answer, but you've asked me a question I've been thinking about.
Please.
The
This is the good stuff.
real unsung beneficiary, I think, of the Gulf conflict is uranium. Here's why.
Interesting.
It has reacquainted humankind, but particularly China, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, with energy security. The last time we were concerned on a global basis with energy security was in the aftermath of the Arab oil embargo in 1973, when oil suddenly became at least partially unavailable. What that meant was, as an example, that in order to maintain their energy security, the French built the fourth largest nuclear fleet in the world. The Japanese, for the same reason, built the third largest nuclear fleet in the world. Post the Arab embargo, we haven't had a supply challenge in energy for over 50 years. Now, in addition to having geopolitical contests for energy, China, as an example, trying to access secure supplies, supplies that have been largely tied up by the Japanese, the Americans, and the Europeans, we have bigger potential challenges. Uranium is, as the Japanese Diet has stated, the only fuel source that's energy dense enough that one warehouse can store enough material to fuel Japan for 5 years. You can't store that much oil if you could buy it. You can't store that much natural gas. You can't store that much wind. And you certainly can't build that many batteries. Your choice, if you're Japan, or an energy dependent nation like Japan, your choice for energy security is uranium. That is your one choice. And that's become, I think, very apparent in the last 3 or 4 months.
So uranium you like long term, and I hear you saying oil as something that we see limitations of, I guess. But last time we spoke, you were pretty bullish on oil, and I mean a lot has happened since then. And but kind of curious as to, I think you and I talked about oil. A lot of people think that oil's relevance is going to be like a 10-year life, where you think maybe 30. Correct me if I'm wrong. Nuance that if you like. But do you still see strong value in oil today? Is it still undervalued, or have the recent Middle East conflicts changed the way we should think about it?
Depends on your time frame. When you and I talked about oil before, I said it was the only unhated commodity left. It's not unhated anymore. So I would suggest to you that the easy money has been made. I could talk to your audience about Exxon at $80 or $90 without
Yeah.
hesitation. It was a matter of time. Now it's 180, 185. Talking about a stock at 185 is different than talking about a stock at 80. The circumstance that we talked about before, well, there were really two circumstances. The first was, and you'll recall this interview, those who I called the big thinkers of the world, Biden, Trudeau, Merkel, those people, would have you believe, and they did have most of us believing, that peak oil demand would occur in 2030, that it was the fuel of the dodo, a thing of the past. I don't know how old you are, Steve, but I don't believe that peak oil demand will occur in your lifetime, let alone mine, and I'm 73.
Really?
That means that people who were looking at the half-life of oil reserves as 2030 need to think about 2065. They need to add the whole tail to the net present value. I'll give you an example. Many people who hear this argument say to me, well, Rick, what about alternative energies? What about them? The world, the Greta Thunbergs of the world, those great physicists, have invested about $10 trillion in alternative energy generation over the last 45 years. A lot of money. And they've reduced carbon fuel demand from a high of 83% 45 years ago to a low of 81% today. In other words, the market share of fossil fuels has declined by 2% over 45 years with an investment of $10 trillion. You can't get around physics. Fossil fuels, in particular oil, are transportable and they are uniquely dense. They're uniquely suited towards petrochemical activities and as a motor fuel. So they'll be around for a very long time. The second part of the equation, I mean, people get the first part wrong. The second part of the equation is that the oil companies themselves, including the state-owned firms, have substantially underinvested in their sustaining capital and productive capital expenses. Wall Street, as an example, rewards companies more highly that divert substantial parts of their free cash flow to shareholders, either by way of dividends or buybacks, rather than reinvesting in their own business. State-owned firms that don't have that overt pressure have a worse pressure. The governments divert free cash flow from the oil and gas business to politically expedient domestic spending programs. Two state-owned firms illustrate this very well: PDVSA, the national oil company of Venezuela, and Pemex, the national oil company in Mexico. In both cases, these state-owned firms sit on top of really, truly vast reserves and resources. And in both consequences, as a capital, as pardon me, as a consequence of the diversion of oil industry cash flows to politically expedient domestic spending programs, including subsidizing gasoline, reducing supply while increasing demand, these companies have experienced 80% production declines in 20 years. We're doing this at a smaller level on the private scale. When you and I talked before, the oil prices that we're experiencing today as a consequence of war were prices that I thought we'd experience in 2029 and 2030 as a consequence of underinvestment. It's entirely likely, if this war ends quickly, I'm not saying it will, that the oil price falls from its current levels to some number like $65 or $70. It's also inevitable that the price rises again by 2030 as a consequence of a lack of sustaining capital investment. The only thing that's changed is that the sustaining capital levels have gone down. Obviously, Iran isn't making sustaining capital investments, nor is the UAE, nor are the Saudis, nor are the Kuwaitis. They have a war to fight that costs money. But in addition to the deferred sustaining capital activities, we've blown up a bunch of producing infrastructure. And all of that needs to be rebuilt. Meanwhile, the Russians aren't making sustaining capital investments either because they have a war. Less excusable, the US oil industry hasn't been making sustaining capital investments because the industry has been at a war with Wall Street, which has been asking for higher dividends and share buybacks. Those higher dividends and share buybacks coming from companies that are not making sustaining capital investments must be recognized for what they are, which is cannibalization. These current payouts reduce the probability of payouts in the future, and people need to understand that.
Rick, so peak oil is still not going to happen in my life. I'm 43, or I'm 44.
Peak oil demand will not occur in your lifetime, unless you live to be very, very old.
I got some good genes or bad genes, depending on how you look at it. So the easy
Let's say
money,
this. I think peak oil demand, not supply, peak oil demand, peak oil supply is a function of price. There's lots
gotcha.
and
All
lots
right.
and lots of oil left. There's not an awful lot of $60 oil left, although there's plenty. But current, $150 oil, there's a lot. But peak oil demand, I'm going to say 2065, 2070.
So the easy money for oil is gone. You still think it's a
Money
good
for oil.
buy? There's a certain money out there. There's yeah. How do you feel about copper? Do you still feel that narrative as an attractive one to follow? And is
Easy
that
money.
still hated enough where you love it?
Easy money has been made in every commodity. The sure money is ahead of us, but the easy money has been made in every commodity. Easy money is when an industry is hated enough that the selling price of the product on a global basis is less than the global cost of production, including tax and the cost of capital. So, as an example, when uranium was $20 and it cost $40 a pound to make it, the industry was losing $20 a pound about 150 million times a year. It was pretty boring, but the resolution of that was either that the uranium price would go up or the lights would go out. Those were your only two choices. And uranium was hated. The easy money has been made. The sure money is ahead of us. Pick a commodity. It's true with all of them, some more than others.
Is the copper story an attractive one for you still?
Extremely attractive. It isn't hated. It isn't even boring, but it's volatile. People hate volatility and they hate cyclicality. And what they don't like about inevitability is that it doesn't suit their time frame. Everybody wants to get rich quick. And with few exceptions, that's not the way that money is made. Let's look just for fun at the arithmetic of copper. I was at Metals Week in London the end of last year, and there was a paper that was delivered that said that the 10 largest copper companies in the world had to invest $250 billion over 10 years to maintain their current production. Now, there's a couple problems with that statement. The first is they don't have 250 billion. They have to raise it. The second is that current copper supplies are in deficit, which means we're using more copper than we're making. So maintaining current production for 10 years doesn't work because eventually you have to ration by price. There isn't enough copper. The third thing is that it doesn't take into account increasing demand. Forecasts of copper demand range from a low 1% compounded to a high of 3.5% compounded. If the copper demand that Goldman Sachs says will occur as a consequence of the build-out of AI data centers occurs, we will use more copper in the period 2026 to 2050 than has been mined in all of recorded history. Meanwhile, for 25 or 30 years, we have underinvested in copper exploration, and it's a long-time business. The needs that I'm talking about occur in 5 years or 10 years. The ability to address those needs needed to begun to be addressed 25 years ago. Your audience can visualize a copper mine by looking at me, a competent guy, but 73 years of age, past his prime. That describes the world's copper mines. Biggest copper mine in the US, best copper mine in the US, Bingham Canyon. 160 years of age. To say it's
Yeah.
past its prime is an understatement. Chuquicamata, best copper mine in the world, 115 years of age. Escondida, biggest copper mine in the world, 40 years of age. Grasberg, most profitable copper mine in the world, 50 years of age. We are living on the Rick rules of the copper mining business, these great big giants that are well past their prime. I'm not trying to say that I don't have more to give. So does Bingham Canyon. The world needs to replace a Bingham Canyon every year. And that's one of the 10 biggest copper mines that's ever been found in human history. Meanwhile, all these things take time. Here's an example. The best undeveloped copper deposit in the United States by a country mile is the Resolution deposit in Arizona. Average grade, 1.5% copper. Average mine grade worldwide, 0.4. So three times the average grade worldwide, over a billion tons. It's a mammoth. Great location, in an allegedly politically secure jurisdiction with power, water, roads, highways, a town full of copper miners. Couldn't
Yeah.
get better. This big thing has been in permitting for 28 years. 28 years.
Yeah.
You get the problem. If you and I, Steve, and I said this in other interviews, if you and I decided it's inevitable the copper price is going to go up, so we're going to raise a bunch of money and we're going to go explore for copper. Grassfields, district-wide exploration usually takes 10 years to result in a discovery. So if we raise $100 million today and we go out and spend the money for 10 years and we do a good job, hire good geologists, all this kind of stuff, government doesn't steal it from us by some strange coincidence. We discover a copper mine 10 years from now. Takes us 2 or 3 years to drill the deposit off. It takes us then two and a half years, maybe three, to finance and permit it. Now we're 16 years out. Hell, 73, I may be dead, but you're doing good. And then it takes us 2 or 3 years to build a mine. So if you and I decided that we were going to impact supply, it would take us 17 or 18 years before we could reasonably be expected to impact supply. Meanwhile, we're going to experience real shortages in 5 years.
Yeah.
There's nothing we can do about that, except profit, of course.
So speaking of mines, as I have been following your work on, the junior mining space, exploration and developers, I mean, I'm learning more and more that the mining projects, most of them never become mines and the success rate is low. Yet you've done very, very well in the space. So how should investors think about the sector, knowing that many bets won't pan out?
Three ways. You greatly impact your success by how hard you work. Specifically, I ask speculators to limit the number of stocks they own to the number of hours per month they're prepared to spend studying their stocks. And I don't mean listening to Rick Rule interviews. I mean reading annual reports, quarterly reports, proxies, stuff like that. If you aren't prepared to do the work, don't risk your money. Educate yourself and then go to work. There are facilities, Naked Commercial, the Rule Classroom, where there are over 300 hours of instructional video on how to do securities analysis. Do that work. Also, understand that the sector is volatile and cyclical, which means that you will absolutely, without a doubt, guaranteed experience rapid price declines. If you've done the work, that's not a risk, it's an opportunity. A stock that you thought was fair value at $3 becomes great value at $2 or a buck and a half. But most people don't have the knowledge of the company or the courage to look at a precipitous share price decline, either due to volatility or cyclicality, as an opportunity. They see it as a risk. Turning your mind around, understanding that money is made on the intersection between price and value, knowing enough to establish some frame of reference with regards to value, and then having the courage to take advantage of price weakness as opposed to getting shaken out is critical. And the third thing is adjusting your time frames. Steve, I've graded in 35 years almost 100,000 portfolios. People send me their portfolios to Rural Investment Media, and I personally rank their portfolios. Grading 100,000 portfolios, I've learned a lot about what investors do. One of the things they do is that although they often have the strategy right, they have the tactics wrong. Specifically, if you think that we're going to ration copper by price in 5 years, you have a 5-year time horizon by necessity. If you have trauma holding stock over a long weekend, the dichotomy between your tactic, which is short term, and your strategy, which is long term, means the probability is that you're not going to make any money. You can be right in your thesis and wrong in your action, and you lose money except by accident. You make real money by application, not by accident. It is true, I believe, that the vast majority of exploration stocks ultimately will be priced at their intrinsic value, which is zero, but that's over a very long time. And it's not that difficult statistically to increase your odds a lot. If you assume, like I do, that 85 or 90% of the small stocks are valueless, the corollary to that is that 10 or 15% of the stocks generate such outstanding performance that they add legitimacy to a universe where 85% of the competitors are valueless. So the real key is separating the wheat from the chaff, finding those 15 stocks out of 100 that have real potential. How do you do that? Well, work, first of all. You need to work. This got a hunch, bet a bunch, doesn't work. High quality people to begin with, serially successful people. Well, where are those successes? Are employed at the task at hand are important. Value relative to price is important. You can have a great company that's way, way, way overpriced, and you still lose money, despite the fact that you picked a great company. You paid way, way, way too much for that company. Understanding how value is created, paying attention to where the company is in the value creation. A pathway is important. And I learned too in my declining years that scale is important. Both big mines and small mines have big risks, but only big mines can make you big money. So if you're going to take big risks, you got to be in the game for big money. You can be right with a small mine and still be wrong. You can still not make any money. If you're right with a big mind, you're going to make money, and probably you're going to make a lot of money. I guess a different thing, people often equate speculation with gambling. That's wrong. In gambling, as the Chinese say, you're doing business with fate. In speculation, you can change the odds by doing the work. It's important to know that the odds aren't fixed. The odds are variable. And if you work harder than the casino, you're going to win and the casino's going to lose. The other way to view it, Steve, is like a horse race, a pari-mutuel race. In a pari-mutuel at a horse race, your horse has to win, place, or show for you to make money. But the stock market's different because you could sell your ticket to a different bettor. Or you could even sell your ticket back to the pari-mutuel window. So your horse doesn't have to win or place or show. It has to appear to be winning in the first turn or the backstretch or the final turn or the home stretch. And if you come to understand that the odds are changing, not in your favor, unlike at a horse race, you can sell your ticket. The horse track. You basically put it in a trash bin. So it's important to note those two things. You can change the odds as you go, and you can also react to the odds changing. But it's an active process. It is not doing battle with fate.
So, Rick, before I let you go, I do want you to know I'm looking forward to the Rule Symposium and seeing you again. You keep talking about your age, and I think you're still in your prime. But I've met a lot of good CEOs of good, great mining companies there. I know that you vet your companies that come. I know that I spoke with who is it, Banyan Gold? I think they're coming, right? And she said that.
Yep.
Hey, when do I get to come? So it seems like you guys are in greater demand than there are booths available. So what does your vetting process look like? And are there specific boxes that each company checks, and why does that matter?
You have to be owned in my own account to come to the conference.
Okay.
Now that doesn't mean I put stocks in three boxes. Core, which means like Franco Nevada or Exxon. I don't worry about them. I mean, I monitor them.
Yeah.
In the course of Franco, as an example, it's likely that the sale decision will be made by my heirs, literally. The second bucket is a much bigger bucket. It's called the active bucket. That's ones where I believe, for various reasons, they will outperform the market, but I'm very, very, very aware of the risks. And then the third is what I call the point of no concern bucket. The point of no concern bucket is a stock that was active, that performed well enough that I was able to sell enough stock to recoup all my capital and pay the capital gains tax, where I think there's still upside, but I'm playing on the house's money. Every company that's at the conference is in one of those three buckets. Wheaton Precious will be there. Agnico Eagle will be there. Exxon sadly won't be there. Those are in my core. Most of these companies are in the active bucket, but some of the companies, like First Majestic as an example, I started with very large positions when they were small companies. I've sold enough that, never mind, I've taken my money off the table. I've taken my money off the table two or three times, and I still have paper left. So it's important to know that I have to own them in order for them to be on the floor. We had over 150 companies apply this year to exhibit who we had to turn down, because we didn't mention, we didn't own them. You mentioned Banyan Gold. She tried to come to my conference, I don't know, 6, 7 years ago when she founded the company, but I didn't own the company yet.
Gotcha.
It was only after she had done enough drilling density on that deposit that I believed her estimate as to the size of the resource that I bought the company. Once I owned the company, I always liked her. She was, after we came to own the company, she was welcome. Now, one thing you will see at the conference is groups of companies. As an example, Inventa Capital will be there. If I own one company in the booth, the whole group of companies may exhibit. So while I own Vizsla Silver, as an example, I don't own Vizsla Copper or other things in that group. So it's important to know that sponsors who have multiple companies, Frank Giustra, as an example, if I own one, they can exhibit. But not every company represented at the booth may be owned in my portfolios.
Rick, any other thing about the Rule Symposium that people who aren't familiar should know about what that is?
Well, there's a couple things. Unlike any other symposium on the planet, in order that my attendees show up well prepared, I interview every single exhibitor before the conference. We know we're going to give you 46 hours of programming in 4 days. You can't absorb it. You can't do it. So I cheat. I interview every single exhibitor before the conference. So an attendee that's willing to do the work can show up at the conference really well prepared. The second thing is that we record the entire proceedings so that you can see everything. As an example, most days we have four breakout sessions. How can you see four sessions? You can't. You have to have the recordings to do that. But some of the presentations are so good that you will need to see them two or three times over the course of a year. Attendees, whether they attend live or live stream, can do that because they have access to the recordings. The most extraordinary thing about the conference, nobody else has the courage to do this, is whether you attend live or live stream, if you decide, for whatever reason, that you didn't get your money's worth, I give you your money back. Unconditional money back guarantee. No other conference promoter that I know of in the world has the jam to do that. That means that this is a riskless transaction for you. If you show up and you don't believe that you didn't get that you got your money's worth, you email me and you get your money back. Now, over 30 years of money back guarantees, we've refunded less than 1/10 of 1% of the tuitions that we've charged. But that guarantee is your listeners' guarantee that our content can make the money.
I mean, money back guarantee, hassle free, no questions asked is what I'm hearing. I mean, you can't beat that. So,
And lots and lots and lots of value. Lots of value. Great big picture thinkers of the kind that you would never hear on CNBC or Fox or CBC. I mean, never, ever.
I'm
Portfolio
looking.
man portfolio managers who've built their reputations over 40 years through good markets and bad, not pup newsletter writers who've made their reputation in the last 12 months of a bull market, but rather the John Hathaways and the Adrian Days of the world, people who've been plying their trade for 40 years. The living legends, Robert Friedland, Ross Beaty, Bob Quartermain, getting on stage telling you how they built multi-billion dollar companies from scratch, the mistakes they made, how it made them better investors, and telling you from stage what they're invested in today. These are important things, all of which allows me to say to you, if you don't think you got your money's worth, I give you your money back. The probability that I have to give you your money back is almost nil, but it gives you the assurance and it gives me the pressure, frankly, to create a product that makes investors money.
Well, I've been the last several years. It's awesome. This year, it's July 6th through 10th. Rick, how do we people find the Rural Symposium, the Rural Classroom? How do they find you?
Well, they find me, as you suggested, three principal ways. RuralInvestmentMedia.com is where I rank portfolios. If you go to RuralInvestmentMedia.com and you list your natural resource portfolios, please, by the way, no crypto or tech stocks, just resources. I'll rank them 1 to 10 for free. That's a really good price. RuralInvestmentMedia.com. Secondly, the Rural Classroom, where Albert Liu and I teach, not just us, a vast faculty. There's over 350 hours of recorded programming there, absolutely free, including free Q&As most Thursdays when I'm in town. There's also now the Rural Investment Media YouTube channel, where we have interviewed every single exhibitor at the conference. Whether you attend the conference or not, this is all free. Again, a very, very, very good price. And then finally, what I consider my masterwork, which is the conference. That's RuralSymposium.com. And if for any reason I don't deliver for you, that's free too, although I'm highly confident that I will deliver for you.
Rick Roll doing God's work. Rick, thank you for being here. I'm just Steve Yang, learning alongside you from great people like Rick. Everyone stay smart, curious, disciplined. Rick, thanks again. Look forward to seeing you at Boca.
Always a pleasure. I'm delighted to be hosting you live at Boca.
All right. Thank you, Rick. Bye.